Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bo Grosskopf, professor of international relations at California State University, who examines the conduct of the Bush administration's war against terrorism in view of the recent bombings in Saudi Arabia and Morocco. Nada Aliyah with the Arab Women's Solidarity Association, who discusses the status of women in post-war Iraq, their daily struggle for survival, and hopes for a better future. And John Nichols, Washington correspondent with The Nation magazine, who takes a critical look at the Federal Communications Commission plan to abandon rules restricting the concentration of ownership of the nation's corporate media outlets. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
There are few international flights going to the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan, as the former Soviet republic has few natural resources like oil to entice Western investors. But in the emerging war on terrorism, Uzbekistan has grown into a major U.S. ally. Its runways give U.S. military C-17 cargo planes easy access to Afghanistan. According to Mother Jones magazine, it's also the home base to the U.S. Army's 10th Mountain Division, which is still chasing Taliban fighters near the Pakistan-Afghan border. The American presence in Uzbekistan makes Uzbek strongman Islam Karimov a key ally in Asia. It also puts Karimov's reputation for repression under the scrutiny of critics like Human Rights Watch, which assert that Uzbekistan is one of the worst abusers of religious minorities in the world. In a recent trial, a dozen young Muslim men were accused of trying to overthrow the Uzbek government. As the men were brought into court, they had visible bruises and welts. Their crime was to have joined the Islamic group Hizb ut-Tahrir, which has been organizing in the heroin-infested Fergana Valley near Kyrgyzstan. The accused were sentenced up to 18 years at hard labor. According to Human Rights Watch, this is typical of Uzbek justice, where five people died in custody in 2002, apparently from torture. In one case last fall, a man was given the death penalty solely on a confession that was extracted under torture. The Nation magazine reports that Attorney General John Ashcroft is cranking up the domestic war on terrorism by giving new powers to local police for the enforcement of immigration laws. Immigration had been the sole responsibility of the Federal Immigration and Naturalization Service. Now Ashcroft has placed immigration information on the National Criminal Information Center database, which is used by local police officers during routine traffic stops. According to civil liberties advocates, Ashcroft's goal is to use immigration data the same way as traffic infractions have been employed by state and local police to crack down on the illicit drug trade. Critics note the potential for racial and ethnic profiling abuse by law enforcement against Arabs and Muslims. Yet, under the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, local police departments have a choice whether to participate in the new Ashcroft drive on immigrants. Several departments, such as Portland, Oregon, have refused to assist the FBI in, quote, volunteer questioning of Arab nationals after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Many police departments are wary of jeopardizing the trust they've built with immigrant populations in their communities. As Sacramento, California Police Chief Arturo Venegas observed, to get in the enforcement of immigration laws would build wedges and walls that have taken a long time to break down. Throughout the lush jungle forests of the Congo River Basin in Central Africa, a new ecological crisis has emerged called the Empty Forest Syndrome, as gorillas and chimpanzees are slaughtered and their meat is sold in cities as far away as London. According to E! The Environmental magazine, Bantu pygmies have hunted these animals for centuries. But chimps came under threat in the last 20 years as international logging companies have opened up Central Africa's forests to development and human settlement. The massive logging has encouraged trappers to come into previously isolated forests to trap large animals. The surging trade in rare animal meat harms other forest animals as well, such as leopards and eagles, whose food supply has been diminished. Additionally, indigenous pygmies are losing their traditional forests and animals to commercial hunters and loggers. Conservationists are also concerned about a potential public health threat, such as an outbreak of the Ebola virus, which, in humans, has been linked to being exposed to gorilla carcasses. Animal protection advocates have launched a major educational campaign in Africa to limit the bushmeat trade, which Heather Eve of the Bushmeat Task Force called a loss of cultural heritage. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
The bombing attacks on targets in both Saudi Arabia and Morocco over the past week has refocused the world's attention on the threat posed by al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Three simultaneous suicide bombings of Western residential compounds in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, killed 34 people, including 8 Americans. In Casablanca, Morocco, 5 locations were bombed, resulting in the deaths of 28 victims. Saudi and U.S. officials assert that the attacks in Riyadh were organized by al-Qaeda, while less is known about the network that carried out the assault in Casablanca. The deadly suicide bombings come after more than a year of U.S. preparations for its invasion of Iraq that the White House declared was an integral part of its war against terrorism. But critics charge that the Bush administration has never substantiated its claim that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden had worked together to plan the September 11th attacks or any other terrorist strike. With security alerts on high in the Middle East and in the U.S., Florida Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Bob Graham recently argued that President Bush's almost exclusive focus on the war against Iraq had allowed al-Qaeda to regenerate. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Beau Grosskopf, professor of international relations at California State University, who examines the conduct of the Bush administration's war against terrorism in view of the recent bombings in Saudi Arabia and Morocco.
It reminds the world, and especially the Americans, I hope, that Americans are not the only people who seek revenge, and in doing so, continue the cycle of violence that we call terrorism. You know, unfortunately, the Bush administration was warned about this in terms of Iraq. They chose to prosecute an unnecessary war. You know, experts all the way from the right to the left have not rejoiced in that coming of that prediction, but simply pointing out to the Bush administration that they plowed ahead against the advice of saner heads, it would appear, and now we see the result.
Bill Grosskopf, comment if you would for us on criticism of the Bush administration lately that the war in Iraq distracted U.S. intelligence agencies and even the military from fighting the war against terrorism, the real terrorism threat that many people feel was evidenced in the Saudi and Morocco bombing of al-Qaeda and its various networks around the world.
Well, if you're talking about the recent criticism coming from the Democratic Party circles, it's purely political. These are people who would not take a hard look at the Patriot Act after September 11th. These are the same people who signed on last fall in terms of giving the president pretty much carte blanche in terms of going into Iraq. But these are also people who are looking forward to November 2004, and they're trying to get a hook at an angle. And so this provides an opportunity. I really don't think that their criticism necessarily is even warranted in terms of the notion that it's distracted from the war on Iraq, because to the extent that the Bush administration has used the terrorism issue, Iraq is part of the terrorism issue, obviously their comeback could be, well, we're still focused on the terrorism issue here, it's just that we've gone to another place. And of course, they played politics with it as well. They're probably pretty dismissive about that criticism and pretty delighted that the Democrats are working to keep the terrorism issue, you know, in the American people's headlamps on their own.
Well, when you look at the Bush administration's policies after the September 11th attacks by overthrowing the Taliban government of Afghanistan and then moving on to target Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, has that done anything to diminish the threat of terrorism from al-Qaeda and associated groups?
No, it's done just the opposite, and that's what we're seeing now. It has simply provided fertile ground and fertile reason for more al-Qaeda recruits, for more copycat Osama bin Ladens, and I'm afraid that that's what the prediction's all about, that these kinds of activities of using terror to fight terror simply continues that that cycle of violence, and people around the world know it. That's why we had all the massive anti-Iraqi protests. They know that the implications and ramifications of that activity would be simply more recruits for people who don't see the United States as such a benevolent power, don't see the United States as really being interested in fighting the general topic of terrorism, but is only concerned about terrorist victims if they're wrapped in an American flag. They see the hypocrisy in all that, and obviously, you know, that causes fertile ground, as I said earlier, for the recruitment of more in the cause.
Have we seen evidence of that blowback, the gasoline on the fire, so to speak? Were the bombings in Saudi Arabia and Morocco, you think, indicative of a wave of terrorism to come, or is this still being gestated by the people of the Middle East who may be drawn to figures like Osama bin Laden after the Iraq War?
The case of Saudi Arabia has a duality to it. There's obviously a domestic power struggle going on in Saudi Arabia between what some people are calling the reformist Abdullah and then other forces within Saudi Arabia who, within the Wahhabi movement, are clearly listening to the speeches and to the ideas of people like Osama bin Laden who find the relationship between the Saudi monarchy and the United States to be disturbing, to say the least, and absolutely blasphemy that they're doing business with the infidels. And then the targeting of Western interests in both Saudi Arabia and in Morocco. So, yes, I don't think there's any mystery to any of this, that this is part of the response to that. And I expect we can probably, we should gear up for more.
What should be done by the U.S. government to confront terrorism now that is not being done by the Bush White House? And are military and intelligence means the only way to fight the war on terrorism?
I don't expect the Bush administration to follow my advice, but if they were open to it, this would be the advice I'd give them. Stop encouraging the American public to think that there is a quick fix to terrorism. Secondly, admit that the United States is part of the problem of terrorism. Some of U.S. allies are part of the problem of the general problem of terrorism. Forgo the policy of answering terrorism with terrorism and begin to also articulate a willingness to involve oneself in more of the collaborative and collective efforts of the international community. And in the meantime, you know, the American people has a responsibility, which is to begin to act like citizens, begin to act like patriots as opposed to jingoists, begin to think for oneself and not listen to the arguments of the jingoists in the White House who simply say, park your brains and follow your leadership. I mean, that's the problem. That's what's gotten us in this situation to begin with. It's too many have parked their brains on the issue of terrorism, said America, right or wrong, my country, love it or leave it, instead of doing the patriotic thing, and that's thinking for oneself. As a patriot, we have a right and a responsibility to think these things through, get as much information from as many sources as we can, and confront people who simply say, follow the leader on these issues.
That was Beau Grosskopf, professor of international relations at California State University in Chico. His book, The Newest Explosions of Terrorism, is published by New Horizon Press. As chaos and violence overtake Iraq in the wake of the U.S. overthrow of Saddam Hussein's government, the fate of Iraqi women is little remarked upon. But the negative change in their status has been far-reaching. Even before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, decades of war and harsh economic sanctions had sparked a revival of Islamic religious practice under the secular Ba'athist regime. Several factions of the long-repressed Shiite Islamic religious majority of Iraq are now competing for power in a future post-occupation government, with many advocating the creation of an Islamic republic similar to that of Iran. The Arab Women's Solidarity Association was founded in Egypt in 1982. It was established by a group of 120 women who declared that struggle for the liberation of Arab people must include the liberation of Arab women. By 1985, AWSA had 3,000 members internationally and promotes Arab women's active participation in social, economic, cultural, and political life. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Nada Aliyah, a representative of the Arab Women's Solidarity Association. A writer and teacher, Aliyah is a Palestinian who was born in Iraq, grew up in Lebanon, and has lived in the U.S. for the past 15 years. She discusses the status of women under Saddam Hussein's regime, the daily struggle for survival they now confront, and their hopes for a better future.
there were no rights that women were denied as women. When you think of Saudi Arabia, where women can't drive, when you think of Afghanistan, where they can't go out without the veil, where you think of places where they can't get an education. No, they were as highly educated, as qualified as men. As I say that, I would not in any way suggest that life was easy. Life was not easy for anybody in Iraq, you know, unless you were very, very close to Saddam, one of his inner circles, then you had it made.
And now, I have not seen women in the public sphere in any photographs that I've seen, you know, coming out of Iraq after the war, including a breadline, which really amazed me.
Yeah.
It was all men and boys, and it made me just really wonder, what is going on with women now, and what do you know, or what does your organization know about how things are there now for women?
Things are very, very scary and very dangerous for everybody now. Just like looting, just like crime, just like killing is rampant, so is rape. Women are being grabbed out of the cars they drive and raped. There's been story after story. They're constantly coming out, these stories that are not being reported, of the lawlessness also translating into rape. Women are driving to go wherever they need to go, for example, to a hospital or whatever. They are being dragged out of the cars and raped right there. Just like the looting is happening within sight of the U.S. soldiers, I mean, that is a fully acknowledged fact that the U.S. soldiers see the looting, see the killing, see the crime, and don't do anything about it because they say they have no orders to stop doing to stop that, to interfere. It's the same thing. You know, when that is happening in front of U.S. soldiers, the U.S. soldiers are not interfering. They have orders to protect the oil ministry, you know. Let's put it bluntly. Their orders is to protect the oil ministry. Their orders is not to protect women from rape. There is just so much crime, and there is no infrastructure of security, so that you have to constantly protect yourself. Women who go out have weapons in their purses. You know, they go with a shopping bag, and there's a gun in there. Mostly the women are, at this point, taking care of the security for themselves, for their families. It's true they're not out in the streets as much, and it's a shocking sight, because here's a case where women were out as much as men. And suddenly, the reversal has happened so that they have become much more domestic creatures. I mean, you know, when you know you're going to step out for bread and get raped, you send your husband to get bread. People are killing each other all the time, too. All the time. All the animosity, all of the ethnic conflict, the Shias against the Sunnis, the Iraqis are killing Palestinians because Palestinians were very much a favored minority by Saddam. The fact that we have liberated Iraq, if anyone believes it anymore, then, you know, you're going to have to start answering questions. You are going to have to be accountable.
Do you know if there are any women's organizations within Iraq, either government-sponsored or autonomous?
Under Saddam, there was one. It was the Ba'ath Party Women's Association, and you had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party, and it dealt with the traditional things that every government has that deal with women, for example, childbirth, education, schooling, all of these things that are traditionally associated with women. Obviously, that our organization is no longer functioning now. I don't know where the members are. You can't be part of the interim government if you were once a member of the Ba'ath Party. So that organization no longer functions. There were no other legal organizations. You know, whatever was underground has not come out. If there was anything underground, most of the organizations that were, Iraqi women's support organizations were based outside of Iraq. They were based primarily in Europe. There were, you know, some in England, some in Denmark, but not in Iraq. And with the state of utter lawlessness, chaos, daily survival for bread, for oil, for electricity, for water, when these are the things you have to deal with, it's hard to organize. I'm not saying that there is no organization. In fact, Iraqi women out of England actually have a plan, the Iraqi Women's Plan for Iraq, that very specifically spells out what their hopes are, what their ambitions are, what they would like to see after the fall of Saddam. And Saddam is gone. So there's certainly something going. But as I said, when you're still dealing with fear for your life, that's your first priority. You stay alive and then you form some kind of plan for the future.
That was Nada Ilia of the Arab Women Solidarity Association. Contact the association at area code 425-558-1006 or visit their website at www.awsa.net. The Federal Communications Commission, chaired by Bush administration appointee Michael Powell, is set to further deregulate rules governing the concentration of ownership of the nation's print and broadcast media. Specifically, Powell and his Republican Party majority on the five-member commission plan to abandon a 1975 rule that prohibits one company from owning a newspaper and television station, or multiple TV stations serving the same market. The commission, which has scheduled a June 2nd vote on these rules changes, is also expected to eliminate restrictions limiting a television network's national coverage area and concentration of ownership of local radio stations. Although Powell only scheduled one public hearing on the proposed deregulation, thousands of citizens have registered their opposition to the plan by attending 9 semi-official hearings organized around the U.S. and writing Congress and the FCC. Many predict that if implemented, the rules changes will result in an extreme transformation of the nation's media and create an ever-shrinking number of media monopolies and less diversity of opinion on the airwaves. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, who takes a critical look at the deregulation plan and the broad coalition of groups that are now fighting for the democratization of the nation's media system.
What we've got are six rule changes at the FCC. The FCC is the Federal Communications Commission. It's a five-member regulatory body that is essentially delegated the power to make bureaucratic decisions as regards media, and that delegation comes from Congress. These rule changes are not your standard bureaucratic tinkering to, you know, make sure an airwave is properly regulated or something like that, though. This is essentially a knocking down of the barriers that have prevented corporate monopoly in a lot of areas of media. I know a lot of your listeners would believe correctly that our media is already too conglomerated, too corporate, too commercial, too vapid, all the other complaints that we can make. But these rule changes would actually make it dramatically more corporate, conglomerated, commercial, etc. They would do so by allowing one company to, if all the rule changes go through, own the newspaper, 2 television stations, 8 radio stations, the cable system, and the primary internet site in a community. The rule changes that are proposing, the most significant of them is a striking down of the newspaper cross-ownership rule. Now, the newspaper cross-ownership rule sounds like just standard bureaucrat jargon. What it really boils down to is that for the better part of a quarter century, we've had a law in this country that says that you cannot own the newspaper and broadcast stations in the same market. Now, there's a few markets around the country where their grandfather clauses allowed that sort of cross-ownership, but most places it's not allowed. This would get rid of that rule. Another change would get rid of the rule that bars you from owning TV stations and radio stations in the same market. And there's also a rule change that would allow networks to merge at the national level, and various other pieces of tinkering that go around these core changes. What you end up with is a situation where the largest media conglomerates in this country will be able to own more media than they've ever been allowed to own before. And the reason that this change is being brought up is not because a single citizen came forward and said, I want Rupert Murdoch to be richer. I want the telecommunications corporations that already control so much of our media to get bigger. No citizen came forward and said that. There's not a single scrap of evidence that suggests that anyone in America, not even that any member of Congress, suggested it. What happened is the telecommunications conglomerates that control more than 90% of our broadcast communications now in the U.S., the telecommunications conglomerates decided that they wanted to get bigger. And so they hired lobbyists. Then they pressured the FCC and the Bush administration, which controls Michael Powell, the chairman of the FCC, to make these changes.
Where are we at now in terms of the number of companies that control the lion's share of our print, television, cinema, magazines, etc.?
We're now down to, in the most recent calculation, 6, although even that is a bit deceptive because many of these companies have partnership deals where they essentially, although they are separately owned, operate as one company. It's reasonable to say, as Ted Turner did a couple weeks ago, that we now have a situation where 5 companies control 90% of all communications in the United States, all commercial communications in the United States.
What are opponents of these deregulatory measures at the FCC doing now to change the outcome or at least influence public opinion about this kind of letting loose of even more corporate conglomerates from gobbling each other up?
What activists are doing is mounting the most significant campaign ever as regards an FCC rule change, and really what I think is the beginning of the most significant media reform movement this country's ever seen. It's incredibly heartening to see what's going on. We've never had a situation in the past where city councils and state legislatures were passing resolutions of the kind that they are. We've never had the kind of broad-based coalition come together on an issue like this. It's amazing, really. And what they're doing is a lot of the core work. They're getting people to write the FCC. They're getting people to show up at FCC hearings, although there have been very few of those. And most importantly, they're getting members of Congress to speak up on these issues. One of the best things that's been happening, as I've mentioned before, around the country are these efforts to pass local city council resolutions saying, don't do this. The Chicago effort resulted in a 50-0 vote on the city council there in opposition. The Seattle effort overwhelmingly, the Vermont effort overwhelmingly. And so, I mean, people can actually do organizing at their hometown level, and it does matter. What we know is that Michael Powell is a political animal. The people at the FCC are very conscious of this opposition. It has an impact. And even if they go ahead with the changes, this kind of activism can build a base that will convince Congress to roll the changes back. Congress has the power to do that. We can't let this be left in the back rooms to the television conglomerates and the media conglomerates anymore. This thing's got to be pulled out into the light of day. And Congress has to make sure that the FCC does not throw down all the rules and make it possible for us to see a corporate feeding frenzy that will ultimately diminish not just our democracy, but our culture.
That was John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. Contact the Media Reform Network, the coalition organizing opposition to FCC deregulation, by calling area code 413-585-1533 or visit their website at www.mediareform.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.